Welcome everyone to the April edition of ABCD GIS, Geography Colloquium. Today we have with us Dr. Ismael Vallejo. He's a professor at Seville University in Spain, where he's currently the head of the Department of Physical Geography and Regional Geographic Analysis. He has a PhD in physical geography, a master's in environmental science, environmental remote sensing, rather, from Aberdeen University in the UK. He teaches GIS and remote sensing, and his research focuses on geospatial analysis of natural hazards, vulnerability, and environmental impact assessment, especially in coastal areas. So with that, let's give him a nice welcome, and I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for your introduction. I would like to take this opportunity as well to express my gratitude to the Real Colegio Complutense for granting my visit in Harvard, and of course as well to the Center for Geographic Analysis for the acceptance of this stay. I am especially grateful to Dr. Wendy Wan for all the assistance. Let me just say thanks as well to all the members of my research group. As you might understand that the work I am going to present is not just my direct work, but it's a collective one, and I want to say that all the people have contributed and they have given some material for the presentation. I would like as well to apologize for a couple of reasons. The first one is for my English. I learned it in Scotland when I was doing this MSc. And I don't think Scotland is a wonderful land, but I don't think it's the best place to learn proper English.
So I will say that you're more intelligible than many Scots. So.
Yeah. Well, in any case, it was so long time ago, and I'm afraid that it's no, this English is not as good as I would like. But well, anyway. The second reason for my apology is because of the presentation. If you look at the title, I'm not going to make a presentation of a cutting-edge research on geospatial science or application. It's a review of the work we have been doing almost in three decades of work in the University of Seville in the Department of Geography. So, I want this to be clear from the beginning. Well, according to the title of the presentation, I have divided this presentation in four main group or block of content. The first one is dealing with, I'm going to try to answer to the question, where is what we study? This is the coast of Andalusia. So I will try to introduce the geographical context. The second block is dedicated to the institutional context. So I want to present my research group. In the third block, I would like to share with you some reflection about why I think it's so important to study coastal area. And finally, in the last block, I would like just to show different examples of the work we have been doing. So let's go to this geographical context first. Here you have your excellent application world map showing the location of Spain, and within Spain, my region, Andalusia. As you perfectly know, we are in the far west of Europe, let's say more properly, the southwest. We are facing the Atlantic with Portugal. But just for me to have an idea of the scale and to make some comparison with your country, I drag the Spain across the Atlantic, and I found for some numbers, just to have this scale question in my mind. I did just for me, but I think it can be useful as well. So as you can see, I mean, it's an impossible comparison in terms of surface, in terms of population. More or less, I mean, your extension is 20 times the extension of Spain. Their population is about 7 times, okay? So I keep on playing, and just to find a space that it was comparable to Spain, I start to select different states from your northeast corner, and I found this magic formula. So if you take New England plus New York and Pennsylvania, you get more or less Spain, okay? In terms of extension and population. Luckily, I'm not going to speak about the whole Spain. It will be too long. And I'm going to speak just about my region, Andalusia. So I keep on playing, and then I change my equation. In this case, you have to take out from New England, Maine, and Connecticut, and you get as well, more or less, the extension of Andalusia. Of course, just in terms of extension and population, because if we look at the weather, I think we win, as I have confirmed in the 2 weeks I have been here in Cambridge. Well, Andalusia is one of the 17 autonomous regions of Spain. And although most of them have a very deep and long historical basis, they were legally established in our last constitution of the 1978 after the Franco dictatorship. According to the division of territorial division of Spain, all the autonomous region are divided in province, in the case of Andalusia, in 8 province, and each province are divided in municipalities. It's more or less states, counties, more or less. From a physical point of view, we can divide Andalusia in 3 main regions. To the north, we have Sierra Morena and all mountain ridge from the Hercynian period. To the south, we have another larger mountain ridge called the Sistemas Béticos, younger as well. They become they belong to the Alpine period, and in the middle we have the Guadalquivir depression, drainage by the main river, the Guadalquivir river. Associated to those units, we have 2 main sectors of coastal line. We have the Atlantic coast, that is the end part of the Guadalquivir Depression, and we have the Mediterranean coast that take part of the Vatic Mountain. In the case of the Atlantic coast, it's a low-lying coast, plenty of estuaries, marshes, wide beaches of very fine sand, and dune fields, as you can see in those selected pictures. On the contrary, the Mediterranean coast is characterized by the proximity of the mountain to the sea. It takes part of this mountain ridge, as I said before. So what we have are narrow beaches of coarse sediment and many sectors of cliff line coast, as you can see in those selected pictures as well. In general, we have an exposed coastline about 1,000 kilometers, 516 miles. But if we consider the main estuarine shore, this length goes to this number that are almost are the double of the exposed coastline. Yeah, for you to compare, New England exposed coastline is about 470 something miles.
I'm sorry, I'm not a geographer, and that was surprising when you said you include as coastline up the rivers. Do you follow all the way up the river to its source?
No, I mean, it's not just the river, it's what is called the estuary. So it's until the tidal range is filling, okay?
Thank
so
you.
That's what marks the an estuary, where you mix the water from marine water and fluvial water, okay? Not all the river.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, so just for us to have a comparison of our object of study. Well, to follow with the second block, let's go to who are we, this research group. But let's start with Seville, that is the city where my university is. And I mean, taking the question of her, you might ask if Seville is on the coast. Why we study the coast from Seville? And the reason I have said to her is that Seville is beside the Guadalquivir estuary, even being 75 kilometers inland, the tidal range is filled here in Seville. Okay. Even more, in recent geological time, this was an entrance of the Atlantic coast, a great bay that occupied all this part of the low Guadalquivir depression. When this great speed closed this entrance, almost closed this entrance, and the low the sea was lowering down, all this area were progressively filled by sediment, becoming first a great lake, then a marsh area, then part is a marsh, and part is one of the most productive agriculture area in Europe. Nevertheless, this aperture, this entrance, allowed the arrival of many people from the East Mediterranean sector, Phoenician, Greek, that have led to us a lot of archaeological rest testimony of their presence. It say that Seville was founded more or less in the 9th century before Christ. Well, the relationship of Seville with the sea, with navigation, is clear along the history of the city. Let's see just that after the Columbus discovery of America, it was from Seville that it managed all the trade matter with the new continent discovered. Today, in the Indian archive, are stored hundreds, thousands of documents and maps about all this period, and is one of the reference sites for American historian that go there to study all these documents. Let's say as well that Seville was the starting point of the first circumnavigation of Earth, whose 5th century we are celebrating just this year, okay? Of course, this relationship is still alive. As you can see, Seville is the only inland port in Spain. When I say the only port, it's a commercial port, a big one, not just a sport recreational port. A big one with, as you can see, the entrance of great vessel. And by those days of discoveries, navigation, it was founded the University of Seville, which take part of the Spanish university system, and we are one of the main public university in Spain. Some number, I'm not going to speak about all of them, just to have an idea, about 70,000 students, more than 4,000 lectures. Other number about the different level of the in the university teaching, in which the University of Seville is involved. Jumping now to geography, our section have 2 departments. My department, that is the Department of Physical Geography and Regional Geographic Analysis, and the Department of Human Geography. We teach in all the 3 levels in the universitary system, in the undergraduate level, apart from the degree of geography. We teach in anthropology or tourism studies or education, etc. We have 2 masters, one dealing with geography and spatial planning, let's say, and other one dealing with geographic information system. My research group is integrated by members of the department I have just mentioned before, okay? And some external members that are associated to a specific project or to different grants. So let's say people that is coming and go, okay? But I mean, all these members are belong to the both department somehow. We make our main research on the application of geospatial data and application to the coast. But we have also applied these techniques to other areas as risk analysis, as spatial archaeology of other field of research. But we I'm going to focus on the GIS and COAS application. About our funding research, we participate in international projects, mainly from the European Union, as well at the national level, project from the Spanish government, and with the regional government, we have project and contract. In this case, we collaborate with different sector of the regional government, but our funding are mainly public. I just want to call your attention because some of the products we are going to show have this logo. Geográfica is a startup that was born in our group, and now is one of the partner of Cartu. Okay, as you can see, they, in our beer, it's always appear this logo because they collaborate with us. Well, let's go to this third block where, as I say before, I want to share with you some reflection about why I think that it's important to study coastal area. And let's start saying that there where land, air, and water meet, it's for sure that we are going to have a great diversity of processes, both in a geomorphological point of view and as well from a biological point of view. So geodiversity and biodiversity is really rich in coastal area. So this makes them very important. But all those processes are subject to a great amount of changes, different changes in different time scale and space scale. In the long-term natural sense, we have changes, for instance, associated to the changes in the sea level. As I mentioned before, we have the case of Seville and surrounding, and you know very well as well, for instance, from your East Coast, where those changes have been really evident in the recent geological time. But we have as well, in a mid-term basis, spectacular changes on the coastal area. Here, for instance, in the Atlantic coast of Andalusia, we have the growth of this sand speed, and just in about 50 years, it has grown more than 1 kilometer. We have a study, and we will talk about this later on. Or even in a shorter period, this sand peak in a beach, it moved from one side to the other, several hundred of meters, almost every year. Okay, so these are changes to have in account, and of course we are daily, even hourly changes that happen on the coast. But of course, we have not just natural process. We have as well human process. As you know, humans like coast very much. They want to live there, or they want to spend there some part of the year or part of their life. You know very well, in your case, for instance, in Florida, where people, once they are retired, they want to go there to spend their last year. Or we know very well in Andalusia, in the south of Spain, where all retired people from Europe want to come to spend their last year there. So this is evident in coastal area. If we look any world map dealing with population, it's quite clear that coastal areas are one of the most densely occupied spaces in the world. You have here some number that I'm not going to comment. They are quite evident. It doesn't matter if we look at the state, if we look to Europe, or if we look to my region. We are always going to see that those areas are, as I say, very occupied by people. And this is just a rising trend that is going to be growing in a next future or in a far future, according to all the projections, according to all the studies. But these human processes have been subject as well to changes. Long-term changes, for instance, with the different historical period when we have different pattern of occupation of the coast. Things, for instance, what it means colonialism, where you occupy first, I mean, the coast as a point, I mean, you to for later on go inside, etc. We have mean-term human changes. Well, we go to the coast of Andalusia, in this case to the Mediterranean coast, and again, in just 50 years, we can see here almost natural condition, and then we can find this. And the same in the case of Almeria, the eastern more province of Andalusia, where we can see these spectacular changes. And of course, we have very short-term human changes on the coast, associated mainly to tourism activities. Running to all this travel and visit of a thousand million of people, those space change every day or during the weekend or during some month of the year, even daily, they suffer very spectacular changes. Well, not to say when the two things happen together, we have changes in the natural process and in the human one. But let's go now to something that is, for me, very important. Hazards. If we look to this map from one of the biggest insurance company in the world, we can see as well that natural hazards are very frequent and intense on coastal area. It doesn't matter if you are talking about geophysical hazard, as for instance, earthquake, or if you look up meteorological processes are as tropical cyclone. In the case of flood as well, as you know, river mouth are very likelihood areas to suffer from flood. If you think, for instance, in an entirely coastal process as the tsunami, you will remember perfectly the case of 204 in the Indian Ocean, 210 in the Chile coast, or you can remember as well the case of 211 in Japan. But you probably have never heard about Spain and Portugal related to tsunami. But in the middle of the 18th century, we have a really big tsunami associated to this earthquake whose epicenter was here, very close to the San Vicente Cape, south of Portugal. And it was a tsunami that affected greatly all the coast, Atlantic coast of Spain and all the coast of Portugal. It was so important that even the famous philosopher Voltaire wrote about this event. In this simulation of this tsunami, we can see how all the coast of Portugal and Spain was affected, but as well the north of Africa, all the islands from Spain and Portugal in the Atlantic coast, and even the coast of France and Ireland. It is said that it was filled in the Caribbean and in some part of the state, of course, as a very small wave, okay? But it was a very big one, and we have to have in mind this type of processes. But what's happened when we have in the same place, the coastal area, a high frequency and high intensity occurrence of phenomena and a quite huge occupation of the same space, that we have all the necessary element for natural risk and natural disaster? This is natural hazard in one side and exposure and vulnerability in the other side. So it's no strange that when we look at the economic losses of caused by natural hazard, again the coastal area appear as one of the main areas on Earth. As you can see, in my region, in your region. But at the other side of the coin, we have as well a problem, because all these people living in the coast, where you have such a great variety of landscape, of nature, etc., give us the basic component of what we call environmental impact. So we have natural richness, we have economic activities, and we have environmental impact. So again, the coast is going to be to appear as one of the most affected places, as you can see in those very well-known image about pollution, etc. or the modification of natural pattern in coastal area, in this case as well on my region. So let's go to the last part of the my presentation, where I want to show some of the project we have been working on during all this year. If I don't run out of time, or you don't take me out by force, I will try to speak about, well, all these things. I mean, just to mention some project associated to one of these different projects. But let me just three slides to present general aspect of this trajectory of this long run of my research group. The first one have to be with the what I have called, as we take the opportunity to have the Boston Marathon, what they call the software marathon. I mean, I think in the same way that you, we have been working mainly with S3 product, and we have run from the old Arkinfo workstation, then we went to PC Arkinfo, then we went to the desktop RGs, and now we are sharing the use of RGs product and QGs with the use of the spatial database software PostGIS as the main software. So we have been running all this marathon of continuous changes of software. Remember the Arkinfo coverage, then the appearance of the JSON file, and all the changes we are been going on. Talking about data, this data puzzle is just to say that in the same way that I think you may, we have been dealing with a great variety and great amount of data, from manual digitizing of, for instance, this all navigation chart, to field-derived data, remote sensing data from satellite, LiDAR, or drone vehicles, of course, web services, or statistical sources. But let me underline the role of aerial photography. For us, especially for geomorphology interpretation of a coastal element, the aerial photography is one of the key element in the data catalog. And as you have seen, I have shown some image of this fly, of this collection, quite often. It was from 1956. Why is so important for us this specific collection? If you look at this plane, maybe it sounds familiar to you. It's an American plane. This fly is called El Vuelo Americano, the American fly. And it was done by the American Map Service, we call the AMS, AMC fly, in the middle of the 50s. So why is so important for us? It's really important, apart from the quality of the fly, that is quite well, because if you look at the development of the tourism in Spain, it was taken just when this was starting. Before the tourist boom. So that allow us to have a starting point of an almost natural coast. And it's not just in the coast. In the whole Spain, we can follow processes in watershed, in a different area, where we have an image of almost some natural condition. And in the coast, this is really evident because we have a very tourism based on beaches and sand and beaches model. So as it was taken in this day, it allow us to see how it was the coast just 50, 60 years ago. And this is a really nice starting point for all our studies. Well, yeah, this is just to say that we have run from paper output to the screen one with the viewer, but it's the same for anyone that have been working in this world in the last years. So let's start with the review of some specific project. So let's start with coastal water. In the case of coastal water, as you, I am trying to always to make a reference so, to some publication related to the project I'm going to mention. Well, as I say, dealing with coastal water, we have different challenge. We have the scale. Normally talking about large spaces. We have another problem with uniformity, because as a contrary or as something very different to land, where we have very different land cover, the when we look to the sea, it's almost the same. So we have here a challenge, and of course, there is an object that is dynamic, is moving all the time. So this is a problem. In this example, both of them in this area, this is the estuary of the Tinto OVL, is a two river that have this main common channel. There is a huge petrochemical complex, okay? So this environmental agency were very interested in try to know how what thing with coastal water and the presence of this petrochemical industry. So the first project, and this is was long time ago, as you have seen in the publication, was try to understand the dynamic of this estuary that have a main channel, then two branches, etc. So what we did was to collect a great variety of satellite image, Landsat TM in this case, and try to group all of them in different type of tidal condition, high tide, low tide, etc., in such a way that we can see how coastal and estuarine water behave in this different condition. We use turbidity, of course, as the proxy, I mean, to follow the movement, the concentration of this coastal water. Then we classify this different image from the same tidal state condition to obtain homogeneous water masses in such a way that we can assess the environmental agency to locate the sampling point to make a very precise quality control of those water, such a way that they don't establish, for instance, several point in what is was more or less the same water masses, just to avoid redundancy, for instance, in the acquisition of information. And in the other part of the work, it was to try to map water quality parameters. In this case, it was a project in which in situ sampling water quality parameter were taken at the same time, synchronically, with the acquisition of the image. So, based on an empirical model, equation were obtained, and all the image was classified to derive this map of quality parameters, as turbidity, suspended solid, and some chlorophyll map as well that were done. The results were good enough. I mean, we think that we are talking about a project that was done very long time ago. Another really critical variable on the coastal study is bathymetry. It's very important because it's critical for geomorphology, for coastal geomorphology interpretation, and as well, I mean, to run all type of processes, modeling. For instance, wave approaching to the coast need, as you know, this bathymetry. So here we are going just to review very fast three different approaches. In this first one, we are talking of all times. We went to this old nautical chart. You remember the speed I was showing before, this speed that grows so rapidly. We knew very well what was happening in the emerged part of the speed. We knew perfectly what was happening in the beaches associated to this growth. But we didn't know anything about what was happening in what is called the submarine, the submerged part of this system. So we manually digitized of this nautical chart from different moment, and we build this DTM model of the seabed, and compare one to each other, just to see what was happening in this part of the system that was so important for us. In this other case, we have another challenge, because, for instance, to may run all this simulation or modeling of some processes, it's very important that we have a continuous DTM of the coastal zone. But here we have a problem, because as you know, the information about bathymetry come from nautical chart mainly, and they have a vertical datum that it came from a tidal datum. And of course, as the tide is different in different part of the coast, the tidal datum is changing all the time. On the contrary, when we think about topographical map, we have a topographic zero that is an orthometric datum. Normally, it's the mean sea level in a specific point. In Spain, if the mean sea level in Alicante, okay? This is the point, the datum from where the topographic map are made, okay? So what's happened is that if we want to have a continuous model in the coast, we cannot say to the wave, okay, let's propagate through the bathymetry, then stop, and then jump to the topography sources. We have to make a continuous model. So we did, in this case, with a tool to build this continuous DTM by correcting the both vertical datum, okay, that was changing along the coast. It's something similar to what have been done by NOAA, this tool that is called Vertical Datum Tools. And here in the state, it have been made just to do the same, to obtain those continuous DTM models. The third approach is very recent, some of our research. I've tried to obtain bathymetry from satellite image. In this case, this is very useful in areas where you have very shallow water, or you are and you have as well very unstable sea foam that are continuously moving, as it occurred in this area of the Guadiana river mouth. It's very difficult for traditional means to make bathymetry there, okay, because the water is quite shallow, and of course, if we use the best mean to do that today is with LiDAR, but of course it's quite expensive, and this can be changing almost every month, so you are not going to make a LiDAR every month. So in this case, we have this LiDAR data, this a bathymetric LiDAR, to compare with the image based on the penetration capacity of some band of the sensor. They did this correlation, correlate LiDAR bathymetry that is was used as the reference data, the true data, with the reflectance obtained by image, in such a way that there is somehow the bathymetry was obtained from those images as well. Error that in the conclusion they recognizing that this information cannot be used for instance for navigation purposes, of course, but it's still very useful to follow the changing in the seabed form very well and with a great periodicity. Well, respect to coastal ecosystem, we have worked in marshes and in sand dunes. In the case of marshes as well, work from 20 years ago, work from 2 years ago. In this case, as well, where used topographical map. The information of marches is very bad. I mean, in this time, because it's very you have very little information, no many point of with altitude or reference of a height point. So they were integrate with information of the creep and information about the vegetation, because it's a really good proxy to know the level of the tide. Okay, vegetation respond very well to the different vegetation respond very well to the different flooding potential of tide. So it was very useful to establish the different level, the altitude level of the tide. That was, as I say, done 20 years ago. Today, of course, we use LIDAR data to in this area, but as well, LIDAR data have problem in marshes area. The vegetation is so dense that you don't have a two responses from the LIDAR beam. You just have the response from the vegetation to, so you don't have the response from the true land position, okay? So in this case as well, it was obtained the height of this vegetation by sampling method just to correct in such a way the information that was being obtained. In the case of sand dunes, we are really lucky. We have, if you remember, I talk about this great sand spit that closed the old estuary of the Guadalquivir, the old bay, and over this speed, we have one of the most spectacular active dune system of the world Europe. This is the Doñana National Park, and we are being working there, following the behavior of these spectacular dunes, and we have done by trying to control the different dimension occupation of the dune ridge and the interdune area, following the advance of the slip phase of the dune, just to know the advance rate of this dune along the time, as well our start point is 1956, the Vuelo Americano, okay? And then we have done as well some volumetric evaluation of these changes. We have used as well a ground penetration reader to see the evolution of some part of this system. At the end, we are concluding of that the system is changed a lot. The sand ridges are becoming narrow, higher, and slower. And this has been seen as well in different part of sand dune in the Mediterranean area. So we are trying, I mean, to make this hypothesis as a general sort of general theory to be proven in to be confirmed, sorry, in different parts. Well, this is one of the central project of our research group, shoreline changes. It's central is critical because it's quite transversal and it can be used in many of the other projects. And it's critical as well because we maintain updated all the time. As soon as we have another aerial photography series for the coast, we follow the changes in the shoreline.
So you know, let's do 7 or 8 more minutes lecture, and then that'll leave us ten minutes.
Okay, that's
because this is fascinating. I want to make sure we have time for questions.
Perfect.
Good.
So well, as you know, the problem is the what is the shoreline or what is the coastline or the term you want to use. You have many lines, as you can see in this photo. So what is the good line? In the aerial photography will be the same. Which is the line, I mean, to take? So in this case, in this example, from different set of aerial photography, we use all the information about when they were acquired, and we use two proxy. What is the foredune position? This is when start the vegetation on the beach, or where is the waterline mark? These two proxy for a shoreline, because we have 4 different days. The scale was done, and it was done by a unique specialist. It was done by one person in all the Andalusia beach. Of course, when it's reached to different part of the area with problem, I mean, we assist this specialist. And once you have this line, we use the digital shoreline analysis system from the U.S. Geological Service. You trace a baseline, you trace a different transect, and then you measure the chain between 2 or 4 or the line you have, and you obtain the different erosion or accretion rate in the area. We integrate all this information in this geospatial database to make different analysis. In the case of cliff, well, the problem is that it's vertical, so we use laser scanning just to make comparison of different day, but this was done just in short, a small sector of respect to sea level. We have done, I mean, the simulation of flooding according to different scenario of sea level rise, and some project integrating different part of what we have done here. For instance, integrating beaches and dune just to classify different type of beach dune system and see how they respond to different moments. Or in this case, that we take all this information about erosion, why of the beach, etc., to make machine learning classification of different type of beach. In this case, we use the coastal vulnerability index to assess the environmental agency according to the sensibility of our coast to future sea level rise. Or in this case, we integrate as well for the environmental agency all information not just about the coast but as well about climate, about drainage area, or about wave or ocean climate, if you want. And of course, risk mapping. One, I have said, we have a lot about natural hazard, but we need as well information about exposure and vulnerability. For instance, in the case of sea level, we have here a paradox. Why? Because we have been doing very well, and when I say we, I mean the scientific community, in hazard mapping. with the arrival of LIDAR, we can have in the flooding map in a submetric resolution. But what is going to happen when I integrate social information? That we are going to the statistical institute, and they told me that this is the unit, the minimum unit, with information about population. So I can say that this is what is going to be flooded, and they say that 250 people are going to be affected. And I say, this is not true, because this building is not affected, for instance. So this is a paradox and a big challenge. So what we did by means of geocoding was to take the direct information from census, from the continuous census in Andalusia, taking the address, try to locate everyone in the door of the building, and put this information in the different buildings. Later on, we can make some sort of grid approach to locate the population, but with a better, much better resolution than this census block, something similar to your census block from the census. So now we can see that we know which building and how many people is going to be affected. This block is going to be, this building is going to be affected and have 6, 7 or whatever people have, and this one is not going to be affected. The same was done for tourism. These are potential user of beaches and tourist facilities, and they were put in grid or in administrative unit or in cadastral parcels. Here, another example of exposure or vulnerability is taking the historical heritage. We have information about what is happening, the hazards that are happening on the coast. Let's see what's happened with our rich heritage, historical heritage, because it's very abundant and very rich. So let's see what is happening. Some of them is already destroyed. So let's see if we can save or at least to be conscious about what is going to happen. And well, these are just some of the last project our PhD are working on. This is a way to integrate a lot of information relating to exposure and vulnerability in this asymmetric and multi-scala and multi-thematic grid. He's working on this just to apply machine learning and high capacity stories of this data, or in this case that we are using cellular automata to simulate changing in urban environment in the coast, to see, for instance, how the seismic risk is going to change according to the growing of the city or the renewal of all buildings. Well, about web dissemination, I don't think I'm going to show you nothing new. It's the typical structure of data warehouse, business layer with a map server and different client using OpenLegend or Leaflet, I mean, to build up the different viewer that you have been showing all the time. Generic viewer for a generic user just to view. We always make this sort of two-window model just to make a comparison that they synchronize. They can be synchronized to see, for instance, different date. And more specialized viewer where the user have a more capacity to require to the database a specific portion or a specific range of data according to the space or according to the time variable, using in this case contextual query language. Here we have another example of a viewer, in this case for all the world, related to climate, and all are in the page of my group. And well, thank you very much for your attention, and that's all.
So about 10 minutes for questions here. Cindy, go ahead.
The bathymetry study on the very shallow and fast changing part of the estuary, have you tried hyperspectrometry?
Well, yes, some of our research are used. Those one is an example with a spot satellite. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's the challenge in this case is it was using not just a very cheap but a very frequent with a very good temporal resolution. I mean, just to follow this thing. But I know that hyperspectral sensor are really good as they can penetrate in a very effective way in the world.
They're expensive too.
They're expensive too. That's the problem, that we are trying to work as much as we can with public data or very cheap data. Mm-hmm. Yes, Josh.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any experience with the blue-green LiDAR to validate some of that.
Well, as I say, we use this LiDAR for validation. I mentioned it's called Charles. It's the one that we have this image. We have just this image in all the coast of Andalusia. I mean, in the water area, we have more LiDAR, of course, in land area. And we took the opportunity, I mean, to make this project just because we have this reference data. And it was this, it's called CHOL.
One other question. So I appreciate your interest in coastal zones because they're so interestingly dynamic and significant. When you're looking at the flooding, I'm curious what methods you used to determine those. Was it primarily topographic? Were you using storm runoff? Or were you using drainage approaches to calculate that?
If you have seen, we in the case of flooding, we are just talking about flooding associated to sea level rise.
Okay. So you're using just
I think it's called the BAD model, that it just you just rise the level and flood an area. You are talking about a storm surge, and there are other colleagues from engineer that may and run this sort of model, we don't. Okay.
Thank you.
When measuring beaches, what determines where the vegetation line ends and the beach begins?
It's pure photo interpretation.
Okay, so it's not a field thing where you're looking for roots or vegetation, and it's photo interpretation.
It's photo interpretation. I mean, a very good scale with a if you apart, for instance, from this historic photo of 1956. That is some part it doesn't have a very good quality. For instance, in some areas it's almost saturated, it's almost all white, okay, because it have a very bad radiometric resolution. But when you have new fly ortho image recent time, is not so difficult when you are talking about 1 or 2 meter pixel to see the line of vegetation. But it's a great work, to do it for almost 1,000 kilometers,
right.
And try to do this draw.
I've been using satellite imagery so far to do just that, try to decide where the vegetation line ends. And my problem is the resolution. Like, I can't tell what's shadow, what is canopy, and where the roots are.
I mean, when you satellite image, of course, are great for many things. For to work on the beach and to draw a shoreline, they are not as good. I know some work that have tried to do that. Okay, and I've been reviewing a paper for some colleague trying to use this satellite image. A lot of satellite image. Yeah, in this case, to discriminate water line in. For us that we try to work in a with a high resolution line, this doesn't work.
Yeah, I've noticed.
That's
yeah.
It. And in my case that I have been working in this Doña Ana National Park dune area, I have a lot of problem to discriminate vegetation in the area. I can, of course, very well, as you have seen, I have discriminate sand from vegetation. So what is the sand ridge and the interdune area? This is obvious. But if I want to be more precise and, for instance, distinguish the different vegetation on dune area, is quite difficult. It's quite difficult. And satellite image, it doesn't help you as long as you say the spatial resolution is not enough.
Is so far, is that the best we've got? I'm trying to find historical data, so far all I can find are the satellite images dating back maybe 20 years. And I'm wondering, is there any other source of imagery that I might tap into that might have better resolution?
Well, you can try with infrared photography, for instance.
What source would I look for? NOAA? Would they have that?
Well, I don't know. Here in the state, I could imagine them. I don't know if a U.S. Geological Survey or NOAA, but in our case, is the better mean to assess vegetation presence because of the capacity of the infrared to detect vegetation.
Thank you.
Just to follow up, I think that the Department of Interior Agriculture Service may have infrared aerial photo with an infrared band. I don't know, every 2 years or every 3 years. It's mainly for assessing crops conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But it may give you the ability to differentiate temperature. For example, if you pick the time and the season where there's wet and dry,
mm-hmm.
Would give you very different temperature. That the infrared band might give you the clearest division.
Okay.
I haven't done this myself, so
yeah,
it's
no,
just a
thank
thought.
You. Okay.
Yeah, the stuff that has the infrared and near infrared bands is NAIP.
NAIP?
Yeah, it's National Agricultural Imagery Program. The problem with that is that it's a 5-year cycle. Well, no, it's 3 years now. Yeah.
So NAIP.
NAIP, yeah. So that's the USDA. They basically collect the entire country, largely for farm purposes.
But they wouldn't have information on the USEI, would they? The Virgin Islands.
I don't know.
Right. Does it include territories?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because her study area is St. John.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Over here.
Can you interpret the height of vegetation and the sand dune? One of the reasons that I'm asking you is that you are just mentioning about the flood and the storm surge that reflected by the height of the sand dune's quality and the height of vegetation. So your satellite imagery can detect the height of vegetation?
But not really. And you can... No, for the height of vegetation, or you have LiDAR data, or you have a very good photogrammetric flight that can make you some measure. Now, I mean, the best way is with LiDAR, of course, but as I say, you have different pulls of LiDAR in the same bin, so you get the information from the soil, from the surface, and you have the information from the top of the canopy vegetation. So you can have what is called what we call a surface elevation model. Okay, but for instance, in marsh area, as I say, is such a dense vegetation that all the pools are on the top of the vegetation canopy. So what we have done is just to go to the field, measure different sampling